This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The Kremlin paved the way Tuesday to annex more of Ukraine and escalate the war by claiming that residents of a large swath overwhelmingly supported joining with Russia in stage-managed referendums. The U.S. and its Western allies have dismissed as illegitimate. Pro-Moscow officials said all four occupied regions of Ukraine voted to join Russia. According to Russia-installed election officials, 93% of the ballots cast in Zaporizhia region supported annexation, as did 87% in the Kherson region, 98% in the Luhansk region, and 99% in Donetsk. Possibly explaining the lower favorable vote in Kherson is that Russian authorities have faced strong Ukrainian underground resistance movements whose members have killed Moscow-appointed officials and threatened those who considered voting. The United Nations Security Council held an emergency meeting following Russia's announcement of the results of the referenda held in parts of Ukraine under its control. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
In a video address to members of the UN Security Council, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky called for global sanctions on Russia for sham referendums and attempts to annex parts of his country. After the meeting, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, announced a joint resolution with Albania, condemning the votes and demanding Russia withdraw its troops from Ukraine. She also warned Vladimir Putin's government.
Let me be clear. If Russia uses its veto to shield itself from accountability, we will then look to the UN General Assembly to send an unmistakable message to Moscow.
The resolution could be before the Security Council later this week or early next. I'm Tim McGuire.
And there is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Denmark believes deliberate actions caused big leaks in two natural gas pipelines that run under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. And seismologists said that powerful explosions preceded the leaks. European leaders and experts pointed to possible sabotage amid the energy standoff with Russia provoked by the war in Ukraine. Although filled with gas, neither pipeline is currently supplying it to Europe. The Danish prime minister said Tuesday that its authorities' clear assessment that these are deliberate actions, not accidents. The incident overshadowed the inauguration of a long-awaited pipeline that will bring Norwegian gas to Poland to bolster the continent's energy independence from Moscow. U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday kept the nation's cap on refugee admissions at 125,000 for the 2023 budget year, despite pressure from advocates to raise it even higher to meet the need after falling far short of the target this year. Refugees advocates have been pushing the Biden administration to do more to restore the U.S. refugee admissions program. The more than four-decade-old program suffered deep cuts under the Trump administration, which slashed admissions to a record low of 15,000. After taking office, Biden quadrupled the number of refugee admissions permitted for the remaining months of the 2021 budget year. He then set the target of 125,000 for the 2022 budget year, which ends September 30th. But so far, fewer than 20,000 refugees have been admitted. Hurricane Ian has knocked out power across all of Cuba and devastated some of the country's most important tobacco farms when it slammed into the island's western tip as a major hurricane. Cuba's electric union says work is underway to gradually restore service to the country's 11 million people overnight. Ian hit Cuba that has been struggling with an economic crisis and has faced frequent power outages in recent months. It made landfall as a Category 3 storm Tuesday and devastated the one province where much of the tobacco for Cuba's iconic cigars is grown. Tens of thousands of people had evacuated ahead of the arrival of Ian. Authorities are still assessing the damage, although no fatalities have been reported. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida greeted South Korea's Prime Minister Han Duck-soo in Tokyo on Wednesday, a day after the state funeral for former leader Shinzo Abe. Han was in Japan to attend the funeral on Tuesday to give condolences for the passing of Abe and also for damages from a typhoon that passed through Japan last week. Kishida expresses thanks to Han for all the messages of condolences and more. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Wednesday, September 28, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the Kremlin paves the way to a next part of Ukraine amid the threat of nuclear war after claiming support for a staged referendum.
It seems that while Russia is making these big, bold threats, they haven't seen any indications that the Russians are kind of preparing for some sort of nuclear attack.
A new report by the African Center for Strategic Studies predicts hundreds of violent events in the Sahel.
What we've identified are sort of five different zones where violence is increasing rapidly and it's having different types of effects on people in those areas.
And over a million people are without electricity in Cuba, while Hurricane Ian takes aim at the U.S. state of Florida and thousands evacuate. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Kremlin paved the way Tuesday to annex part of Ukraine and escalate the war. Moscow claims that residents of a large swath of voters overwhelmingly supported joining with Russia in a state-managed referendum that the U.S. and its Western allies have dismissed as illegitimate. Hours before polls closed, one of President Putin's allies, former president and now deputy chair of his Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, issued a stark new prediction and warning over the use of nuclear weapons in the conflict. He said if Russia did use nuclear weapons, NATO would be too afraid to respond and would still not directly enter the war. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan had warned Moscow earlier this week of, quote, catastrophic consequences, unquote, if it uses nuclear weapons in Ukraine, raising tensions over a major escalation of the war. For more, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Barb.
Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder just spoke to reporters today, and we asked him about the nuclear threats that we were seeing out of Russia. And he said on several different occasions that the U.S. military and the Pentagon has seen nothing that would cause them to change their nuclear posture. So it seems from this building, at least, that while Russia is making these big, bold threats, that is all they are, their word right now. They haven't seen any indications that the Russians are kind of preparing for some sort of nuclear attack. The thing to note is, in the case of something like an ICBM, the U.S. military has a great oversight on this. They can tell if a unit's been mobilized to sort of deploy some sort of missile. But where it gets more difficult to parse is when you look at some of the weapons that Ukraine uses that can be used for regular, normal, conventional weapons, or those that can be used with nuclear weapons. And so we don't really know if Russia can switch out these weapons and use a nuclear weapon against Ukraine.
The U.S. National Security Advisor earlier this week talked about a red line that Moscow should not cross and talked about grave consequences if that happens. Has that been clarified by the Pentagon as to what he's talking about and as to what the consequences might be in the event of Russia using nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
Clearly, the Pentagon has a vast nuclear arsenal that it has been modernizing and upgrading. It's called the nuclear triad. The U.S. can reach out and respond to any sort of nuclear attack against the United States with ICBMs on the land. That's one leg of the triad. They can reach out via nuclear weapons on a submarine. That's another leg of the triad. And they can also use their bombers to strike by air. That's the third leg of the triad. So there's a vast and robust nuclear response that the United States has. It doesn't want to use that. That's clearly a last resort. And they've said that all along. And they've said that even talk of using nuclear weapons is irresponsible. And that is why Secretary of State Anthony Blinken just said in recent days to stop the loose talk about nuclear weapons, because it shouldn't even be on the table.
That's VOA correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from the Pentagon. Heavy fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces is underway in parts of eastern Ukraine and the northeast Kharkiv region. In addition, Ukraine says it has destroyed Russian-operated Iranian drones in the Odessa region. That is a claim the VOA has not been able to independently verify. For more on the fighting taking place, reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller with this update.
For the past couple of days, the city of Odessa itself actually is under constant drone attacks. At first, three drones were attacking Odessa and only one was shot by Ukrainian air defense. But then next two attacks, actually, Ukrainian forces managed to destroy all of them. It's difficult to explain why. At least we don't have this explanation from the military. But all the time we hear that there are three drones attacking Odessa. And one of the first drones that was shot down. Actually, it was shot over the sea and it was brought to the land from the sea. And at that point, it was confirmed that this is the Iranian drone that actually Russia purchased from Iran and now is using in the war in Ukraine. So Ukrainian military said today that actually another three drones were destroyed over Odessa region. They were targeting the city of Odessa. These are kamikaze drones and previous ones actually targeted the city center and buildings. Administrative buildings were heavily damaged in the city center of Odessa.
You brought up the city of Mykolaiv, which was also on the brunt of some shelling that was also taking place.
Yes, exactly. Actually, the city of Mykolaiv was hit twice during the night today by very heavy shelling from the Smerch rocket launchers. What we know for the moment that there is a number of civilian objects in the city centers that were damaged by this attack, including buildings, stores, and water supply network. We know that the city of Mykolaiv is actually in the middle and on the way for Russian forces to the city of Odessa, and it's constantly under attacks. But again, recently, these attacks, we hear more and more about the attacks are more quite bad, actually. So what we can say that, again, during the night and also during the day, there are shellings that continue and Ukrainian forces is doing their best to protect the city because it also has a very important strategic place and strategic meaning in this war.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. The United Nations Human Rights Office said on Tuesday that Russia's invasion of Ukraine had caused a dire human rights situation and led to a wide range of rights violations, including extrajudicial killings and torture that could amount to war crimes. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said in a report that it was particularly concerned about torture and ill-treatment of detainees by Russian forces and affiliated armed groups, but said there had been right violations by both sides. The head of the mission for the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Matilda Bogner, held a news conference to present the report.
The vast majority of civilian casualties that we have documented since the 24th of February were caused by the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, for the most part by Russian armed forces and affiliated armed groups. Shelling from heavy artillery, such as multiple launch rocket systems and missile and air attacks, include weapons that carry cluster munitions, were used repeatedly. While OHCHR has not been able to assess compliance with international humanitarian law for each individual incident, the scale of damage and destruction strongly indicates that violations of international humanitarian law have occurred. The heavy toll that these weapons have had on civilians is evident. The armed conflict has led to a wide range of violations of the rights to life, liberty, and security of persons for both civilians and combatants. We are gravely concerned by the unlawful killings, including summary executions of civilians by Russian armed forces in more than 30 settlements in Kyiv, Chernihiv, Kharkiv, and Sumy regions. Following several field visits to settlements in Kyiv and Chernihiv regions, we've corroborated willful killings of civilians by Russian armed forces. In some cases, they shot civilians while fleeing in their vehicles, crossing the road on foot, or gathering basic foodstuffs, sometimes by snipers. In other cases, the killings amounted to summary executions.
That's head of Mission 40, UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Matilda Bogner. UN human rights officials have condemned the violent crackdown by Iranian security forces against protesters angered by the death of a young woman who allegedly failed to comply with Iran's strict dress code. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Protests across 15 Iranian provinces erupted following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini while in police custody. She was arrested September 13th by the so-called morality police for allegedly not wearing the hijab properly. The UN Human Rights Office says it is difficult to get a precise number of people who have been killed wounded, and arrested by Iran's security force. This is because of restrictions on telecommunications. State media put the number of deaths at 41. However, UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says non-governmental organizations monitoring the situation have reported higher numbers of deaths. She says one credible source reports 76 people have been killed, including women and children. She notes that hundreds of others have been injured across at least 11 provinces.
We are extremely concerned by comments by some leaders vilifying protesters and by the apparent unnecessary and disproportionate use of force against protesters. Firearms must never be used simply to disperse an assembly. In the context of assemblies, they should only be used in case of an imminent threat to life or of serious injury.
Hundreds of people reportedly have been arrested, including human rights defenders, lawyers, civil society activists, and at least 18 journalists. Shamdasani says women have been protesting the wearing of the hijab for 4 decades. But the alleged police beating of Amini and her subsequent death apparently was the last straw. She says this time around, there has been a real outpouring of support from all walks of life and from many different provinces across Iran.
Women human rights defenders who have protested the use of the hijab or who have taken steps to remove it, they have for many years been targeted, intimidated, harassed, arrested, beaten up. There are several pending cases of women who have been detained and charged in relation to the hijab.
Iran has denied that Amini was beaten while in police custody. Shamdasani says the lack of an adequate response to the death of Amini and the outpouring of anger on the streets, as well as the shutdown of communications, has had a serious impact on Iranian society. She says the UN Human Rights Office is urging Iranian authorities to address the situation. She says there needs to be an investigation and respect for freedom of assembly and of expression. She adds that the government should stop vilifying the protesters and instead listen to them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Hurricane Ian tore into western Cuba as the major hurricane Tuesday and left 1 million people without electricity. Now it's on a collision course with Florida over warm Gulf waters expected to strengthen it into a catastrophic Category 4 storm. Ian made landfall early Tuesday in Cuba's Pina del Rio province, where officials set up 55 shelters, evacuated 50,000 people, rushed in emergency personnel and took steps to protect crops in the nation's main tobacco-growing region. Ian was expected to get even stronger over the warm Gulf of Mexico. In Florida, 2.5 million people were ordered to evacuate. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Gino Dolfo in Washington. A new report out today by a Washington-based think tank says 2,800 violent events are projected for 2022 in the Sahel. That's double the number over the past year. Dr. Diane Eisinger, a research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says violence in the Sahel has expanded in intensity and geographical reach. He tells Carol Van Damme that deterioration in the security environment, the region is marked by an array of differing actors, drivers, and motivations.
This part of a growing set of insurgencies in this region, which is, it's very expansive. What we've identified are sort of 5 different zones where violence is increasing rapidly and it's having different types of effects on people in those areas. And in each case, you have a different set of actors that are responsible for that violence. But overwhelmingly, what they're doing is taking advantage of very fragile contexts where the countries responsible for security haven't been able to protect communities.
Speaking of those actors, I'm just wondering if there's interaction between those actors, because 80% of the acts took place in northern and central Mali. Is the violence there responsible for insecurity that's occurring in Burkina Faso and western Niger as well?
So in 2017, 80% of all violent events took place in northern and central Mali. But over the last 5 years, we've seen that shift. And so today, more than 2/3 of violent events linked to militant Islamist groups in this large area of the Sahel actually take place outside of Mali. And so what started as a Malian-based militant Islamist insurgency has really changed its spread. And as it spread, it's incorporated different actors. So it's a real challenge to sort of separate these groups, but I'll try. You get folks that talk about two different groups or two different sets of groups, one being called JNIM or Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, which sort of roughly translates to the group in support of Muslims and Islam. And then you have another set of actors, Islamic State Greater Sahara Fighters, and they sort of have pledged allegiance to Islamic State, but they're actually an offshoot of past groups that pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda and have very local roots to this part of West Africa. So you have this sort of hodgepodge of different actors, and each sort of wing here, the JNIM actors and Islamic State Greater Sahara actors, all have sort of evolving roots that go back to different local groups that have exploited criminal networks, smuggling networks, trafficking networks, and only in the last 10 years have they really taken on this violent extremist ideology. And the group that really professes or exhibits that ideology in its strongest form is Massina Liberation Front.
That's Dr. Dan Aizenga, an expert on the Sahel and primary author of a new in-depth report by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on the expanding violence in the Sahel. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme in Washington. NASA has successfully crashed its DART spacecraft into a faraway asteroid Monday in a test of the world's first planetary defense system. The experiment is designed to avert a potentially catastrophic meteoric collision with Earth. The ambitious mission has been supported by Australia's National Science Agency. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Oh, wow. Awaiting visual confirmation. All right. Let's see. We got it? Waiting.
And we have impact.
There were celebrations at the mission's operations center outside Washington, D.C. 10 months after its launch, NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART mission, has successfully slammed into a distant asteroid. The aim was to crash the spacecraft directly into the moonlet hard enough to shift its orbital track around a second, larger asteroid. It will, however, take days or even weeks to establish how much the smaller asteroid's path has changed. Rebecca Allen is from Australia's Swinburne University's Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the mission was a great success.
It was incredible just because it was, you know, a full bullseye, if we can call it that. You know, you were expecting maybe it could glance off the side. Is it going to hit exactly where they wanted to? And once again, NASA doesn't disappoint with the precision of the impact of the DART spacecraft.
NASA's DART mission has been supported by Australia's National Science Agency, CSIRO. It manages the Canberra Deep Space Communication Complex, one of three stations around the world that make up NASA's Deep Space Network, and was to receive the final signals from the spacecraft as it approached and hit the asteroid known as Dimorphos. Planetary defense experts have said that altering the course of a menacing asteroid or comet is preferable to blowing it up and creating multiple pieces that could rain down on Earth. Australian astrophysicist Kirsten Banks says NASA's DART mission will test our planetary defences.
It's going to change the orbit of that asteroid a little bit around the bigger one. We'll be able to see a slight change in the period, so the how long it takes that little moonlet to orbit around the asteroid, and quantitatively measure the effectiveness of this particular method of planetary defence.
The two asteroids that were part of NASA's DART mission are both very small compared with the asteroid that hit Earth about 66 million years ago, wiping out about 75% of the world's plant and animal species, including the dinosaurs. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Mars lander InSight has been gathering data about the deep interior of the red planet since it touched down in November 2018. One of the lander's instruments is a seismometer, which senses various surface noises caused by earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and meteor strikes. NASA's InSight team says the lander has detected vibrations caused by four separate meteoroid impacts in 2020 and 2021. The space agency used data from InSight to create what such an impact sounds like. According to a recently published study, the impacts took place between 85 and 290 kilometers from InSight's location. NASA says it's the first time seismic and acoustic waves from an impact have been observed on Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including outraged protests, a fearful exodus, and acts of violence continue across Russia days after President Vladimir Putin announced a partial mobilization to call hundreds of thousands of reservists to fight in Ukraine. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Elections are a cornerstone of the democratic system of government. Attempts to target the U.S. electoral system are an attack on the United States' democratic values. It is therefore no surprise that the U.S. government takes any attempt to undermine or manipulate the American electoral system seriously. The Russian Federation has demonstrated determination in its attempts to undermine the democratic processes and institutions essential to the functioning of our democracy and that of other countries, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. In response, the United States is sanctioning two individuals and four entities that support the Kremlin's global malign influence operations and election interference activities. Alexander Viktorovich Yanov, president and founder of the anti-globalization movement of Russia, uses his position and various companies to promote Russia's disinformation agenda and has worked with Russia's intelligence services to support organizations they believed would create socio-political disturbances in the United States. He is also the president and owner of Yanov Transcontinental and Domain Registrant of the website Stop Imperialism. Yanov was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted for or on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation. At the same time, the anti-globalization movement of Russia and Yanov Transcontinental were designated under Executive Order 14024 for being owned or controlled by Yanov. Stop Imperialism was also designated under Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of Yanov. Natalia Valerievna Borlinova is the founder and president of the Center for Support and Development of Public Initiative Creative Diplomacy, also known as PCREDI or Creative Diplomacy. Both Borlinova and PCREDI are directly funded and directed by Russia's intelligence services, which also track the career paths and positions of participants in PCREDI-sponsored events. Borlinova was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation. PCREDI was designated pursuant to Executive Order 14024 for having acted on behalf of the government of the Russian Federation and for being owned by Borlinova. The Kremlin has repeatedly sought to threaten and undermine our democratic processes and institutions, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. mission. The United States will continue our extensive work to counter these efforts and safeguard our democracy from Russia's interference.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.